Session number 13170.
Professor Hanbury Brown, Reel 2.
Anyhow, somewhere in the early 1939, I can't remember exactly when, the priorities of development of airborne radar changed, and it was decided to focus more effort on AI, the development of AI. I suppose people realized that the war was pretty imminent and that air defense against bomber aircraft was more urgent. Anyhow, we built the first, we put together the first AI complete system using components, of course, which had been largely developed for ASV, into a fairy battle. The only difference between the AI and the ASV systems was, of course, that the AI system used four antennas, receiving antennas, whereas the ASV system only used two antennas. ASV had left and right, but AI had left, right, up and down. So the rotating switch which distributed the antenna to the receiver had to have four channels instead of two, so that had to be made specially for AI, and we had in the end to use two cathode ray tubes for the display, one for left right and one for up down, rather than the single cathode ray tube that was used on ASV. So AI was more complicated than ASV. There was, as a matter of fact, another complicating thing, which was that the RAF had asked for a minimum range of 1,000 feet, which meant that the pulse width had to be very small and the bandwidth had to be good and, you know, the response of the equipment had to be such to give you a separated echo at 1,000 feet. That was difficult. Anyhow, we had a lot of discussions about how to present AI to a fighter pilot, and we realized really that we couldn't present it to the pilot. We must have an operator. So in the fairy battle, we had four antennas for receiving and one transmitting antenna looking forwards, a four-way switch, two cathode ray tubes. We had the whole blessed thing mounted in the back of the battle. And the first complete installation I tested in June 1939 in the ferry battle using a Harrow, Handy Page Harrow, as a target. It worked very nicely. We got a maximum range of, I saw a maximum range of 12,000 feet on the Harrow. And we sort of intercepted. We made mock interceptions on the Harrow to make sure that the up-down, left-right display system could actually be used. And that worked out very nicely. And so after that, we had a whole stream, of course, of VIPs who came to see the thing, from Fighter Command and the Air Ministry and everybody from Charwell to Churchill. I had the job of showing the thing to Churchill myself, so I remember that very well. We didn't take him up in the air. We jacked the aeroplane up on the edge of the aerodrome and flew the target round the aerodrome, and Churchill and I sat in the back of the battle. And I showed it to him, and he was very interested in it and asked a whole lot of very relevant questions. And I always remember him saying, "I call this thing the smeller out. It smells out the aeroplane, the enemy aeroplane." Anyhow, unfortunately, this demonstration of AI was too successful, far too successful, because Fight Command decided that they would fit 30 Blenheims and send them for air test to squadrons, of which the principal squadron was number 25 squadron at Northolt, a night fighter squadron. I can't remember the man's name, but I have a feeling the squadron leader, Hallings Pott, was the name of the chap. But The other squadron alongside was 600, and they were very interested in it, but they didn't get it. That was run by a man called Viscount Carlo, who was an extremely intelligent and interesting person. This business of fitting these Blenheims brought to an end all further research and development, all further research, so to speak, on AI and ASV for the time being, which was, of course, a pity, really, because had we had time to go on, we would have made certain improvements to the AI, and we would have done things like interception, a lot of experimental work on interceptions and so on, and stuff which needed doing. We weren't able to do any of that.
So there was a certain amount of unjustified complacency at that stage, you mean?
Well, not complacency. I mean, it was urgency. You see, we had to fit 30 Blenheims with Mark I, you see. And our Mark I was really a breadboard, which we demonstrated in the Fairy Battle. It wasn't an engineered thing. There had been no time for the proper engineering of the equipment. And, in fact, the transmitters, which Metropolitan Vickers, as far as I remember, copied, were actually copies of our sort of breadboard thing. We were absolutely horrified by this. Anyhow, also, there was probably Martlesham Heath, where we were working, was not really set up for this sort of work. We had to park these Blenheims all around the aerodrome. We had to borrow workshop people from everywhere we could to come and do the fitting. And, of course, we did it, a lot of them. And we delivered the first ones to 25 Squadron. The first four or five Blenheims were delivered on something like August 1939, which was only a month or so before the beginning of the war. The first AI sets went to 25 Squadron then, and they went without any operators, any test gear, or anything like that. I mean, the interesting thing is, you see, that at that stage, the RAF had absolutely no understanding, and the Air Ministry had no understanding of the difficulties of introducing new weapons into an existing force. I mean, the idea of training and maintenance and spares and all that sort of stuff. For a complicated thing like a radar set in an airplane, there wasn't any of that at all. They thought, you just put it in and try it. And I had the job of going down to Northolt with the Blenheims to introduce them to the Royal Air Force. That's not a very nice job, because the Night Fighter Squadron at that time, anyhow, which was just the beginning of the war, was fairly concerned with its own internal problems and training and all that sort of thing, and to have some new and complicated device with inadequate facilities for maintaining and teaching the people to use it was not really very welcome. However, the point was that it was near fighter command, and of course Sir Hugh Dowding was personally interested in it, and he saw the problem of night interception, that there would be no method of catching an aeroplane in the dark. And so he was really desperately interested in the thing. Anyhow, when my Blenheims first went down there and stood on the tarmac, the first day they were there, we were told that the group captain Orlibar, who was the station commander, told me that Dowding was coming to see them. So we all lined up with our best suits on, and the staff car rolled up with a flag on it, and Dowdy got out, and he looked at these Blenheims, and he said, "My God," he said, "you've put the thing in the front of the Blenheim. That's no use at all." And these were, I think they were long, I can't remember whether they were short-nosed, long-nosed Blenheims, I think. "You put the thing in the nose." He said, "That's no good at all. That's the first thing that'll get shot at. And anyhow, the light from the equipment will expose the fighter to the gunnery of the bomber. Move it into the back." So I said, "Well, sir, we can't move the transmitter into the back. We couldn't move a whatever it was, 3 or 4 or 5 kilowatt pulse transmitter into the back of the airplane and feed an antenna in the front of the airplane. We just couldn't do it. We didn't have the right sort of feeder equipment at that time to do it. So I said, we can at least stop the light by putting a box around the transmitter, and I will move the receiver back into the back of the Blenheim. I can do that. And although I would point out that we agreed with Flight Command that it should be in the front so that the operator could talk directly and easily to the pilot who was sitting more or less beside him. And Dowding said, well, maybe so, but I want it in the back. Put it in the back. How long will it take? So I said, well, we could do one in a week, sir. And he said to me, Brown, he said, you remind me of a hymn. 1,000 ages in thy sight are but an evening gone. And he got it, snorted, got in the airplane and drove away. However, we had very good people. We had a very good man at... I had a very good assistant at Northolt. Mind you, in the wartime, everything was far more difficult because the war was just about being declared at this time. And we moved the thing. Satisfactorily, we moved the receiver into the back of the Blenheim, and we screened the transmitter so that it didn't give any light in the front. And then we had to communicate this fact to the people at Martlesham, who then had to make this modification to the other aeroplanes that were being fitted. We then had the problem, of course, of training the people to use it and of maintaining it without any test gear. We had no wave meters. We had no method of... And that was difficult. I did training flights between London and Oxford continuously with the crew. And another complication was that we were near the headquarters of the Air Ministry. I can't remember the name of it, but Sir Henry Tizard's offices were not far away. And he sent for me one day, just, you know, we were terribly busy. He sent for me one day and he said, look, it's just occurred to me that there may be a fallacy in this radar system, that if you have if a fighter aeroplane has two targets at the same range, it won't be able to tell where either of them are, because the azimuth and elevation display will be confused. And I said, yes, sir, but the time for which that's likely to happen is extremely small, and I don't think it's important. And he said, well, that may well be your opinion, but I want it tested. Well, that wasted about a week, because we had to get two Blenheims at exactly the same range from the fighter aircraft and fly up and down between Oxford and London, making pictures of what the display looked like. And when I'd finished all this and sent it to Tizard, it's all right. I mean, he'd forgotten all about it by that time. I've never found that to have been any trouble in AI at all. I mean, the time for which it happens is so small that it just doesn't matter at all. But the thing that did matter happened later on. Once we got some crews trained and equipment installed in these airplanes of 25 Squadron, we did some controlled interceptions in the sector, in which pseudo-enemy aircraft flew across the sector, and we were supposed to intercept them by AI. Well, I've never really seen anything like it. The enemy aircraft flew across the sector, and the sector control tried to get the AI airplanes into a position such that they could use the AI, which had a maximum range equal to the height above ground, but if you're 10,000 feet above, you have a maximum range of 10,000 feet. You couldn't have anything longer than that, because the ground returns obliterated everything beyond the 10,000 feet. However, they could never get the airplane into the right position relative to the enemy aircraft in order for these people to use the AI. And That's only the first part of the story. The second part of the story was I watched the night fighter squadron take off in the dark one night on a false, report of enemy aircraft coming up the Thames estuary. And they took off. Well, the first trouble they had, actually, of course, was that there was low mist at the airport and their gyro instruments didn't work quickly enough. But still, that was a minor point. But the point was that the squadron was divided up into sectors, into sections. And each section, I think, had about three airplanes in it. I can't remember. But the point was that in the leading aircraft, the radio transmitter system worked normally. It was a thing called a TR-9D. It had a clock on the pilot's dashboard, which went round, and there was, for a quarter of the minute, 15 seconds in each minute, there was a red sector. During the time that the clock was in this red sector, the radio system on the aircraft transmitted on another frequency to DF stations on the ground so they could fix the position of this aeroplane. For three quarters of the minute, it was available for ordinary RT communication. So that was the system by which the fighter aircraft was located. Now, the system by which the enemy aircraft was located inland was the observer corps. Stalwart, elderly gentlemen, many of them, with binoculars, looking up and reporting the position of the enemy aircraft to sector control. Now, of course, quite apart from the fact they couldn't see the aeroplane in the dark, nor could you see the enemy aircraft above, if it was above the cloud, in point of fact, even in the daytime, it was difficult to make an interception because the position of the fighter given by the DF system, three stations triangulating on the transmission in this quarter of the minute, had a certain time delay on it. The transmission of the information from the observer corps had a different time delay on it. So there was an unknown time delay between the plots on your board. And this was, in fact, so defective a system that I actually witnessed the fact that they could not get the fighter aircraft within the necessary AI range of the enemy bomber in the daytime. And it didn't take much imagination to realize that the AI system, as planned, was in effect useless. And that was in 1939, late in 1939, November 1939. And there was no inland radar plotting system. Once the enemy aircraft had crossed the coast, nobody knew really where they were. There was no method of plotting them. So how the AI was supposed to intercept them inland, God knows. There was a proposal, Dowding, in fact, suggested it at once, to use the CH stations on the coast, the coastal radar systems, for guiding the fighters. They were supposed to give them some system in which you took a bearing on the enemy and you gave the fighter that reciprocal bearing as a vector and so on, and they tried this thing out. It was tried out at Bordsey Manor and elsewhere, and it was proved that you couldn't do it. You simply could not, with the CH stations, get the accuracy required to get the fighter in the right position relative to the bomber so that it could use its AI. An essential part of the whole radar system had been omitted. And this is the worst mistake in the planning of radar in the war that was made, as Watson Watt admits in his book. In November 1939, I wrote a memorandum to Taffy Bowen, my boss, from
Martlesham Heath, from Northolt, and I said, it's called, I can't remember the name of the memorandum, but it pointed out that if you were going to intercept a aircraft at night, the night fighter had to be very accurately positioned relative to the bomber in order for it to be able to intercept with the sort of range that AI systems had of 2 or 3 miles. It had to be within a certain number of degrees in course, a certain number of degrees, a certain number of feet in height, and a certain number of miles per hour in speed for any hope of a successful interception to take place. And this point had been overlooked, although there had been extensive trials at Biggin Hill of daytime interception. For some reason, which I don't understand, the problems of nighttime interception had not been visualized. As a consequence of my memorandum, Bowen wrote to, forwarded it to the superintendent of TRE, whose name was A.P. Rowe, and then Fighter Command were consulted, and they supported the idea. What we suggested, what Bowen suggested this memorandum was, of course, that an inland radar should be designed for the control of fighters, and that it should have a rotating narrow beam, which he called Radio Lighthouse. He had, in fact, put that suggestion forward in 1938, and it had been rejected by Watson, Watt, and Rowe. They hadn't understood the importance of it, and they were fully occupied in the development of the CH system. So, that's how GCI started. GCI was started as an urgent application. W.B. Lewis, of course, I placed a contract for the work on the PPI. The CHL was modified to produce the rotating beam. And the first GCI stations were developed, were delivered to the Royal Air Force in about October 1940. The first significant number was early in 41. The first five stations came in 41. Now, it wasn't until that time that AI was operationally effective, because you simply couldn't get the fighter into position relative to the bomber so that he could use the AI. Seems an obvious point, but it's true. The AI, in the meantime, during all this time, from when I was talking about Northolt and so on, was developed and improved. The Air Ministry, probably with the advice of Tizard and Watson Watt, did something very sensible and far-sighted. Instead of sending the AI, as they had originally, to 25 Squadron, operational squadron, for test and development, they realized that this was not an effective way of developing a new complicated instrument. They established a special unit called the Fighter Interception Unit, FIU, under Wing Commander Chamberlain at Tangier. And the job of FIU was to develop AI into a practical system and test all these damn things under operational conditions. And they did a wonderful job. And I was for a time a technical officer of FIU. Now, we took the AI, which by that time had reached Mark III, and tested it, Chamberlain and I, and we discovered that apart from anything else, it was giving confusing indications. In fact, the azimuth indications were reversing at altitudes, at relative angles of depression and elevation greater than 45 degrees due to reflections off the cowling of the Blenheim. And the reason for that was that the antenna system that had been put on the long-nosed Blenheim had been copied from the short-nosed Blenheim or vice versa, and this was one of the troubles with AI. We cured it by turning AI from horizontal to vertical polarization. The other great debate about in the development of AI was the minimum range. There was an awful row between Dr. Bowen and A.P. Rowe and W.B. Lewis. You see, the airborne section was divided. The airborne people were working at a place, we were working at a place called St. Athan in Wales, where we were installing AI and ASV and aircraft. And the main station, TRE, the radar station, main body of people was at Dundee for a long time. And this division alone caused a good deal of friction. All the administrative work had to be done between these two places, which were so far apart. And you know how misunderstandings arise. Well, they did arise. And one of the misunderstandings that did arise was that the minimum range of AI, that the trouble with AI, why it wasn't operationally satisfactory in the Royal Air Force, the real reason, of course, was that it wasn't GCI, but it was thought that one of the reasons why it wasn't satisfactory or doing any good was that the minimum range was no good. They said the minimum range must be at least 1,000 feet or something. But of course, point of fact, this really didn't matter very much at all. I mean, the thing was not much use anyhow. However, there was a lot of friction about that. And that is where Bowen and Rowe and Lewis really fell out, which in the end led to Bowen leaving radar in England and going eventually to work in the radiation laboratory in America. That's how we lost one of our best people. It was a friction, a misunderstanding. And temperamentally, of course, Bowen and Rowe never got on. And anyhow...
What was the difference in their temperament?
I have to go into it.